Welcome back to our final afternoon here today. We're going to start out talking about immunotherapy and other non-targeted approaches to non-small cell lung cancer. We're happy today to have Dr. Lucio Gordon from Gainesville, from the Florida Cancer Specialists, co-moderating with me for this session. Dr. Ram Govindan from the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, and Dr. Stephen Liu from Georgetown University in Washington. So, we have this sort of research to practice. These are all the faculty who've been here this weekend. And, you know, the whole challenge that I give to our co-moderators like Lucia was to ask you guys tough questions. And so here's some examples.
Ah, good question.
That's a good question.
It's a great question.
I think that's a great question.
That's a great question.
This is an important question.
That's a fantastic question.
It's a good question.
That's a great question.
That's a great question.
That's a really great question.
That's a great question, Neil.
Great question.
Great questions, Neil.
A very good question.
A really good question.
Great questions.
An excellent question.
That's a great question.
That's a really important question.
Very important question.
Great questions.
Really good question.
That's a good question.
It's an excellent question.
So with our co-moderators here, we've gotten a lot of good question comments this week, and I hope it'll continue for the rest of the afternoon. So we're going to start out talking about localized non-metastatic non-small cell and then first-line and later-line therapy for metastatic disease. But I just want to kind of get an update. I was asking Stephen, you know, we're into bispecifics nowadays in general. Now we've got one in small cell, tarlatamab.
Yep.
And we saw one at the World Lung Meeting, ivonescimab, which targeted, I think, VEGF and PD-1. It was, done in China. It looked pretty, actually, compared to Pembro, it looked better, I guess. But, of course, there wasn't an arm looking at maybe IO plus Bev there. Any thoughts about IO bispecifics in general? You know, have CD3 bispecifics now, you know, in tarlatamab, for example. Any thoughts about where this might be heading, Stephen?
I think it's the future. We get very excited about the bispecifics, and it's more than just targeting the VEGF and the PD-L1 pathway. Really, this is a setting where that one molecule is greater than the sum of its parts, where through cooperative binding, by engaging to one ligand, you're more likely to bind to the other in the right environment. And so what we're seeing with the Harmony study, as you mentioned, Harmony 2 showed ivonescimab versus pembrolizumab, those curves looked like pembro versus chemo. You know, the hazard ratios we're seeing were remarkable, certainly outperforming what I'd expected. And what we saw was benefit across PD-L1 strata, across histology. It needs to be replicated, I think, in a Western population with a Western regulatory oversight. But if that holds true in the repeat studies, I think this will change how we look at immunotherapy throughout lung cancer.
Govindan, any thoughts?
I agree with that. I think I also want to point out that in the past, we tried a number of combinations, Pembro plus something else, and really most of them did not pan out. And so the fact that we now have a very nice positive study is quite significant.
Got to ask you, Lucy, have you used tarlatamab?
We do. We are expanding the footprint of bispecifics across FCS. We currently have eight to 10 sites. The plan is to have 18 sites ready by the end of 2025, and we're going to carpet the state in 2026 with bispecifics. So we're doing for small cell, myeloma, of course. Yeah, so excited. Exciting.
Yeah, we were talking about that today in the myeloma session, and the whole issue of who's going to manage these patients is getting more and more shifted to the general medical oncologist.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a look at some data, and then we'll see if we can come up with some challenging questions for you. So, Govindan?
Great. Thank you, Neil. So I thought I'll just go over a few things. You know, over the past several years, we have learned that postoperative chemotherapy improves survival following resected non-small cell lung cancer after complete operation. And we have learned that over the past few years that preoperative chemotherapy and immunotherapy could make a difference. And I'll just run through those preoperative chemoimmunotherapies, or the neoadjuvant therapies. Then I'll review the perioperative therapies where patients got immunotherapy in the back end after getting upfront chemoimmunotherapy. And then we'll talk a little bit about where the adjuvant therapy trials are. So this is a very well-known CheckMate 816. In the interest of time, I won't belabor the study design, but the bottom line is when patients got nivolumab and chemotherapy compared to chemo alone, in largely stage 2 and 3 patients, this is what happens. Your pathological complete response goes up compared to chemotherapy tremendously, from 2 to 24%, and you now see, the primary report showed an impressive improvement in the event-free survival, and that is obviously more pronounced in the high PD-L1 expression. And over the past few years, we've been getting updates of that, and these updates reaffirm the benefit. You can see a nice reduction, over 30% reduction in the event rate. You can see here the PFS is event-free survival is holding up, and there is also a trend towards, there's also an improvement in overall survival, and that's something is quite reassuring, and that is the updated results. And in fact, a final updated results will be presented soon, and these are the updated, information about the overall improvement in overall survival. And so clearly, what is amazing is giving 3 cycles of chemotherapy and nivolumab seems to improve the event-free survival as well as overall survival. And there are no post-operative therapies recommended as a part of the study, although a small number of patients did get some post-operative therapy, but largely all the benefit were confined to the initial upfront therapy. So while this is a fantastic progress, and by the way, this is well-tolerated, no safety signals, what we are all familiar with adding chemotherapy with checkpoint blockade, there are a number of studies that show that perioperative therapies also help. Here, patients get upfront chemotherapy and immunotherapy, surgery, and then they get a year of immunotherapy alone. This is the durvalumab and chemotherapy followed by durvalumab. Again, you can see a 30% reduction in the event-free survival, and overall survival data are fairly immature at this point, but the trend is towards the chemotherapy-immunotherapy arm, and the same thing with the pembro. And here you have the same thing, only difference is that pembro instead of durvalumab, and again, 4 cycles, largely 2 and 3 patients. And you can see, once again, very similar numbers, 5 to 6 times more responses here, and you can see a nice improvement in the event-free survival, same in the hazard ratio, the 30-40% range. And the overall survival, you know, we can see this initial analysis here, you can see that there is an improvement with the survival here with the hazard ratio of 0.72 in the overall survival. The CheckMate 770 is a bit different, where this is the same like 816, but the patients got postoperative nivolumab. And as the data mature, I think it will be nice to compare and contrast. That's a big question here. What do I do after induction chemoimmunotherapy? Do I give some more immunotherapy towards the end? That's something we'll discuss, I'm sure, towards the discussion part of the presentation. And this reproduces what we saw with nivolumab in the induction therapy regimen. The response rates are much greater with the chemoimmunotherapy, and then we can see, once again, a 40% reduction in this. One of the updated presentation that happened a few months ago, Mark Award presented this. What are the outcomes compared to the patients who get 4 cycles or less than 4 cycles? As you could expect, patients who had 4 cycles did better than those who got less than 4 cycles. More notably, the proportion of patients who got postoperative therapy was dramatically less in the group of patients who couldn't get the 4 cycles of neoadjuvant therapy. And again, these are exploratory analysis. I won't read too much into that. But even patients who have less than 4 cycles appear to benefit from therapy. And then very briefly to review the postoperative studies that we had in the past from the near postoperative adjuvant studies. Mind you, these patients did not get any therapy up front. They had surgery, they got chemotherapy, and then they got randomized to immunotherapy or observation. There are 2 studies, the IMpower010 focused on tezolizumab. And there was a complicated analysis in terms of how the study was analyzed. But the larger point is that there was an improvement in disease-free survival across the group, particularly over 1%, more dramatically in those 50% or more. Didn't make a big difference whether you remove the EGFR mutants or ALK, but the larger point is that this is true for many studies. The more benefit is seen in those with a high PD-L1 expression, 50% or more, but it is seen in greater than 1%. And these are the interim analysis. They are still not mature, and And we can see the trend towards the benefit here. Once again, more benefit towards those with a high expression. I didn't put the treatment-related side effects, but in general, they are similar across all studies. You have treatment-related, the grade 3-4, in the preoperative studies, around 30-40%, largely manageable, no major treatment-related events causing death or other unexpected complications. In the postoperative, similar to that, the discontinuation rate is not very high. And in terms of biomarkers, in terms of outcomes, once again, looking at the forest plot curve here, you can see a very nice difference here between 50% or more. And that's been shown repeatedly in various studies. You will see more of that moving forward, the use of ctDNA. The one thing I want to say is, in the early stage lung cancer, the presence of circulating tumor DNA is low, or the prevalence is fairly low. So that leads to false negative results. So unless the tumor is large and it has nodal involvement, you can have a false negative ctDNA in the presence of micrometastatic disease. But if the ctDNA is present, these patients don't do well. And this is a very small analysis of the IMpower010 trial, showing that both groups had a benefit, but it turns out that the patient with ctDNA positive did not do so well as you would expect. But I do think this will change, and the more and more technology will incorporate methylation-based assays. They are much more sensitive, and I think that's going to change the way we do the minimal disease assessment, and that's going to change how we use these data moving forward to decide who should get postoperative therapy or not. This is the Pembro adjuvant therapy studies, which many of you are very familiar with, the same study design. And once again, it showed the benefit in terms of disease-free survival, overall survival trending towards. We'll see more of that updated data as we come along. What else is there happening in the new adjuvant study space? There is more and more effort to add other checkpoint blockade. This is these are drugs that are almost unpronounceable. The oleclumab is the one that targets the adenosine pathway. The monalizumab targets this pathway, NKG2A, which is really one of those self-defense mechanisms we have to prevent the immune cells acting against our own normal cells. The cancer cells co-opt that approach, and they upregulate this pathway. So this is also a way to turn on the CD8 cells as well as the NK cells. And the orlostomig is the CTLA-4 PD-L1 combined approach. And these are being tested in this. And there's also a new development where you're combining the antibody drug conjugate with immune therapy. There is some expectation that it will cause more cell death and can activate the immune system. And there is some expectation that this combination would even be better, the ADC combinations, than plain old chemotherapies. All we have is, can we do it? Yes. And a proportion of patients who head to surgery is pretty high, and numerically a little higher than what we've seen in phase 3 studies. The response rates seem a little bit more promising than what we have seen early studies. Again, these are small phase 2 studies. I won't read too much into that, but the point is, can we do this? Yes. Should we do it? Only phase 3 studies will tell us. And this seems to work across various different population groups. So I think we'll see some more data as we go along. As we wrap up, I think these are the adjuvant studies. You have to remember the IMpower010 and the pembrolizumab studies, and they show benefit in DFS. And we have the pure neoadjuvant therapy, this CheckMate 816, with a pathological response rate in the 20% range. There have been a number of small phase 2 studies. We don't have to go through it. And these are the three perioperative studies you should be aware of, one with Pembro, one with Dura, one with Nevo in the perioperative setting. And the advantage of giving neoadjuvant therapy as opposed to postoperative therapy is that there's a biological basis that when the tumor cells are there expressing the neoadjuvant therapy, you give immune checkpoint blockade, it is potential that you can have memory T cells enriched, and there is some good immunological rationale to use this checkpoint blockade with an intact tumor system. We'll discuss this more in detail. And also, it may allow us to downstage some tumors and improve the resectability. And you can see the response. You can study those patients who have persistent disease. And eventually, you can come up with better strategies in the adjuvant setting than what we have today. So there are a number of those things. In the last minute or so, I want to briefly talk about the locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer, not resectable. And this is, you all know this very well, the Pacific study that clearly showed an improvement in overall survival following consolidation durvalumab after chemoradiation therapy. The natural interest is that can we now combine IO with chemo radiation? That's exactly what we did with chemotherapy. We began with sequential approach, and then we combined them. But here is where you got to be careful. The early studies, once again, showed, can we do it? The answer is yes. And these are two studies, one with tislelizumab, one with nivolumab. They showed, basically, the phase one part of the tislelizumab study was just giving chemo radiation and then chemotherapy, nivolumab, chemotherapy, tislelizumab, and continued. And the nivolumab study was doing concurrent chemo radiation with nivolumab. Both showed some promising early results, some toxicities that was not totally shocking. But this is a killer study, Pacific 2, phase 3 randomized study, where patients got durvalumab with chemo radiation versus the old-fashioned just chemo radiation alone. You may ask, how can you do it? This was done from 2018 to 2019, when this was become a standard, durvalumab, and this also done ex-US largely, and the results were striking. That addition of durvalumab during chemo radiation did not do any better than just plain old chemo radiation. This is in contrast to what we saw with consolidation durvalumab. So the point is, combining durvalumab during chemo radiation may not be a good thing. That's an important message, and we'll discuss this more in detail later on why this happened. And this is a summary of all the options we have in early stage lung cancer. If you have a stage 1 to 3 large tumors, stage 2 to 3, we have preoperative, postoperative, perioperative treatment, and all these are options. They are all equally good options in my view. Thank you.
So in a second, I'll see if Lucio has any questions he'd like to throw out to you, but Stephen, I'm kind of curious about this oleclumab and monalizumab and the data in the neoadjuvant setting. It looks kind of encouraging. Any thoughts about that? And also, I think at least oleclumab and monalizumab, I think, have been also are being looked at or have been looked at in the stage 3 locally advanced with Durva. Have we seen any data there?
So data are still emerging, and the NeoCOAST 2 study, I think, was very interesting. I think these PCR rates are very encouraging. But this neoadjuvant space, we've got to thread that needle. We want efficacy, but we can't do something that will make someone so sick they can't go to surgery. So if we start jeopardizing surgery, people are too toxic, they get pneumonitis, they get malnutrition from stomatitis, we delay surgery, we're doing a disservice. Where I think the future's going, all of these phase 3 studies that Govindan pointed out show one thing that's consistent. ctDNA clearance seems to be a pretty powerful predictor of PATCR. If you don't clear the ctDNA, you have virtually no chance of PATCR. And if we achieve PATCR so far, that seems to be a very good surrogate for EFS. So if our short-term goal is to push PATCR, why not start somebody with a GN with KEYNOTE-671, and then if we don't clear the ctDNA, could we then escalate by adding one of these more toxic drugs only where it's needed, and people who clear their ctDNA, maybe they're fine with just a KEYNOTE-671, a CheckMate 77T approach, and then we'll get the PATCR. So I think that we'll see more adaptive biomarkers, escalation of therapy as we get a little more sophisticated with delivering these drugs really where they're needed.
Yeah, I was going to ask you too, also, Govindan, about this issue of, you know, and when these studies first came out of neoadjuvant chemo IO, there was a lot of concern about delaying surgery. Was it going to affect the surgery? Where are we now? I mean, there's not an insignificant number of stage of a grade 3-4 immune toxicity in the neoadjuvant setting, and I'll be curious to know whether Lucio has seen any patients who've had delays going to surgery. But what do we know globally in terms of that?
Globally, a lot of the side effects, grade 3-4, are related to neutropenia that we typically see in the chemotherapy setting. And it turns out that what is unique about having all this data right now back-to-back is that they all tell the same story. You know, what proportion of patients end up going to surgery? It's around 70 to 85% or so. There are various reasons that come in. Interestingly, a good number of times it's progression of the disease. These patients have occult micrometastatic disease. They declare themselves, and you probably wouldn't have benefited them by doing surgery a couple of months earlier, perhaps. And then the R0 resections, once they go to surgery, are pretty high, and the pneumonectomy rates are much lower. And the postoperative complications are not significant, like what we used to see in the chemo radiation days, in the pre-op wound healing, problems with fistulas and things like that. So to be honest with you, this has been a very good surprise that how well these treatments are tolerated. In fact, when you go to the surgical meetings, the surgeons are very excited about this compared to what we used to see in the chemo radiation days.
Yeah, we saw the same thing, I don't know how many years ago, in breast cancer, where initially there was a lot of pushback on neoadjuvant therapy. Now the surgeons are sending those patients over.
So,
Lucio,
Neil,
any thoughts?
Yeah,
questions?
I have a couple comments and maybe questions as well. So, to your question about have I seen delayed in surgery, yes, I've done the CheckMate 816 for one patient out of several, of course, and he had a history of remote history of ITP like 20 years ago, and then his platelet counts were in the low 40s for quite a while, much longer than expected from chemotherapy. So I ended up delaying treatment surgery by 6 weeks because I had to place him on prednisone for a while, and then he did okay, and the ITP never recurred. So I guess, how often do we see this? Probably not very often. But let me ask a question to the panel here. So 30, 40 of us here, maybe 100 in the virtual room, will go to clinic tomorrow. What is the approach that each of you think is the best for a patient with stage 1B, 2A, or 3A that we see in the clinic tomorrow in the neoadjuvant setting? What's the two-go regimen and why?
Steven?
You know, I think largely these are pretty interchangeable. I do prefer the 4 cycles versus the 3 cycles. I think we're a little more comfortable with that. To me, the key point is really that initial decision. It's patient selection. It's, is this resectable today? And many surgeons will hedge, and they'll say, well, it's pretty close. I think we'll get there.
Right.
And then after 4 cycles, they say no. I think that's part of that 20% attrition is people that maybe weren't truly resectable, and we were optimistic. We're cancer doctors. We have to be optimistic. But I think the decision on resectability has to happen up front. Today, we got to pin our surgeons down. Is this resectable now?
Yeah.
Because if not, we're probably delaying the treatment that they actually need. And then the other, in terms of patient selection, really is that mutation testing, which can be challenging to do on sometimes a fine needle aspirate or small tissue. We want to be sure we're directing EGFR and ALK to a different path. Right now, my preference is KEYNOTE-671. This is a perioperative, the first to show a survival benefit. But this announcement that CheckMate 816 also led to an OS benefit, I think, is big news. And so the devil's in the details. We'll have to see when those data are presented.
Before I ask Govindan to respond, anything else other than ALK and EGFR that'll get you turned off to use an IO?
Yeah, where do we draw that line? For me, RET, ROS1, these really do behave much more like EGFR and ALK, and I prefer a different algorithm there. BRAF, MET, those can respond quite well to immunotherapy, so I lump them in with KRAS and the wild types.
Govindan?
So, you know, I agree with Steven, but I also think we should take into consideration many things. One is presence of comorbidities. Second, smokers and non-smokers. It's an interesting group. And also, as you said, resectability. You know, if patients, the optimal group that benefits from all this new adjuvant therapy, in my view, is those patients with stage 3 patients, high PD-L1 expression. So if you have 50% or more stage 3, without a question, my view, I would say preoperative, perioperative chemoimmunotherapy like 617 is what I would do. Stage 2 patients, it is not that you cannot do. You can do that. You can absolutely justify that, same regimen. But you have an option of using it in the postoperative setting as well. And so if somebody has zero PD-L1 expression as, you know, non-smoker, stage 2, I would go straight to surgery and then reevaluate after that. And especially with a more tumor, you may find more targetable alterations than you have. So now, there are different ways you can dice this.
So before I get back to Lucio, just come back to you, Stephen. All the complications I've heard of IOs is the first time you even thought about ITP. What an interesting. So have you seen that before? And what kinds of prior history of autoimmune disease will get you to hold off on neoadjuvant therapy?
Yeah, neoadjuvant is a slightly different calculus here because we're not talking about an incurable cancer where we view risk a little differently. Here, I really want this person to get to surgery, and I feel that if I interrupt that, I delay that, I have the chance to maybe do a disservice to that patient. I've not seen ITP, but it's only a matter of time before we do. I think a
makes history sense.
It absolutely makes sense. So I think that if someone had a profound history of prolonged ITP, maybe I'd be a little less likely. Now, that being said, multi-station N2 really sort of advanced right on the cusp of stage 4. There was some concern, would they derive benefit? They seem to derive more benefit than anybody else. And so in those settings, it's competing risks. I think a history of autoimmune disease that required systemic treatment that I think could interfere with surgery, if we caused a flare, I'd be much less likely to do it for a stage 2. For a stage 3, I think you got to take it case by case, and I think that smoking status does make sense.
Lucio?
Yeah, I have a comment, a question again. I just more like an operational issue. I think neoadjuvant immunochemotherapy today for lung cancer kind of resembles the issue with referral sources and patterns from urology to us. We are struggling, honestly, to see patients come to us before surgery still. And how did you do this in your academic centers? I think it's probably easier. We have like 100 sites, and it's a little bit probably easier for you to put everybody in the same room and do it. But any comments, any suggestions?
Yvinden?
Two words. Tumor board.
Yep, yep.
And I think that's where you can constantly influence this. It takes time, though. I do think surgeons need to be... Surgeons talking to surgeons is very helpful. And this is where I think we have to bring people, surgical colleagues who have operated on these patients, can reassure them. Will there be some fibrosis after immunotherapy? I'm sure there is. But then those are the issues that they can address better than us.
Yeah.
And but I think it's a question of time.
Stephen?
I think that when surgeons don't refer, I truly believe our surgeons want the best for their patients.
Absolutely.
And if they're not referring, it's because they don't necessarily believe those outcomes are better.
Right.
And so I think that if we can illustrate that, as Gavin has said, by having our surgical colleagues outline those data, we saw surgical outcomes were better with neoadjuvant therapy, and ultimately survival is better. And so that's what really shows it. There's a question, do we need a randomized study of neoadjuvant versus adjuvant? Cooperative groups are going to do that with the PROSPECT trial.
Yeah, one thing we're doing, sorry to interrupt, I made a summary of the neoadjuvant data for our surgeons locally, and tried to put one data in one page, and that kind of helped. I saw an uptick in referrals too, and we'll do more of it.
Micro videos.
Micro learning, yes.
One final point, till today, we don't have an information to suggest one is better than the other. We have data from preoperative therapy, perioperative therapy, and postoperative therapy. So that's what Stephen is referring to. The PROSPECT trial is going to compare preoperative therapy or perioperative therapy with postoperative adjuvant therapy, led by my colleague, Dr. Morgenstern. And this is a practical study, pragmatic style design. So this is a fantastic trial to do in practice, community practice, nothing, very limited data collection, all from electronic health records, a modern way of doing clinical trials. If you can complete the study, that could address this important question, in my view.
Great. All right, let's move on and talk about metastatic disease, Stephen.
Yeah, happy to do so. Let's focus on metastatic non-small cell without a target. That's, metastatic is still our most common stage, about 48% from this year's SEER numbers. And we think of this setting, the first step is really, really important to make sure there's not a target there, to be sure patients have had proper testing, including RNA, to be sure it wasn't a bone biopsy with decalcification or just liquid, to really be sure that we're not going down the path of driver alterations. And if we're not, really the treatment is immunotherapy. It starts with immunotherapy. The value here is not necessarily that it responds in everybody, but the potential exists for long-term survival. Here's the 5-year follow-up from KEYNOTE-024. When Martin Rech first presented these data at ESMO 2016, we showed that immunotherapy was superior to chemo, better PFS, better response rate, better safety, and ultimately better survival. And it's not an incremental gain. You see the median goes from 13 to 26, but we don't look at the medians here. It really is achieving that tail, that long-term survival, our 5-year survival rate, 32%. The control arm, 16%, but again, this is a study that had crossover, and many patients received immunotherapy later. Immunotherapy gives us the potential for long-term survival, and depending on how you want to use the word, potentially cure. So that's something we really don't want to sacrifice. And we have lots of different ways we can deliver immunotherapy, really guided by the PD-L1 status, whether it's monotherapy, whether it's chemotherapy, combinations with or without anti-VEGF, or dual checkpoint blockade. The real question is, which of these strategies is superior? And very similar to what we saw in the early stage setting, we know all of these are better than chemo alone, but we don't have a lot of direct comparisons between these studies. When we choose our immunotherapy regimens, one thing to remember is that PD-L1 is a spectrum, that our cutoff for high is 50%, but in these retrospective data, we see that 50 to 89% doesn't nearly do as well as 90 to 100. We see the response rate 90 to 100, 60%. PFS 14 months, compare that to 33% and 4 months, and huge survival differences. So the details matter here. Ultra-high PD-L1 is a little different, not just in setting our expectations, but maybe in the future in choosing our selection strategies for treatment. Now, what role does chemotherapy have? It's our standard for PD-L1 negative, for PD-L1 low. Is it better? What is it adding other than toxicity? Is it an additive benefit? Is it a synergistic benefit? And in that PD-L1 high group, Should we be giving chemotherapy? The Insignia trial through our cooperative group is a very important study looking at patients with PD-L1 positive non-squamous lung cancer, randomizing to chemo pembro or pembro, really giving us an answer to the question, what is the better strategy? Second question answered, after progression on pembro mono, do we move to chemo alone or do we continue the pembro? Is it adding benefit or just adding cost? This study is metaccrual, and so we look forward to seeing the results hopefully in the near future. We think of predictors. There are positive predictors like high PD-L1, but there are also potentially negative predictors. We know now that mutations in STK11, KEAP1, in the setting of KRAS predict for almost no benefit from adding immunotherapy. Those patients really seem to not benefit from adding pembro in multiple retrospective analyses. Now, there may be a benefit with CTLA-4, with using dual checkpoint blockade, and data from both CheckMate 9LA, CheckMate 227, and Poseidon show that those subset with STK11 and KEAP1 don't seem to derive as much benefit from the addition of a PD-1 inhibitor, but by adding dual checkpoint, we may be able to elevate those curves. Is that better than just chemo IO? Is this predictive, or is it simply prognostic? The phase 3B Triton study will give us some answers. Here, I think a very bold strategy, a direct comparison of KEYNOTE-189 versus Poseidon. Is CTLA-4 providing benefit in this subset of patients with KRAS, STK11, and or KEAP1 mutation? So this study ongoing. I like these head-to-head comparisons. We're going to get some clear answers that will take a few years to really get these results. So for immunotherapy, long-term survival is our goal. And now we know that it is possible, not rarely, but for quite a large number of patients. While our five-year survival at 30% is clearly better than what we grew up with, some of those patients do still progress. We look at our five-year PFS, not quite as good. So what do we know about resistance? Well, really, we're still learning. It's pretty heterogeneous. We're trying to develop some empiric strategies here. And Dr. Karen Reckamp presented the lung map data looking at pembrolizumab plus ramucirumab, the VEGFR2 antibody. And what we showed was response rate, PFS, not really different, but interestingly enough, a survival benefit with using pembro-ram compared to standard chemotherapy. Hazard ratio here, 0.69. This is being followed up by the phase 3 SWOG Pragmatica study, a study that has also completed accrual and hopefully will give us answers soon. But pembro-ram, is this better than chemo? Is there some way to use VEGF to unlock immune benefit? Now, some are skeptical in the room, and I think one of the reasons to be skeptical is we've tried this a lot with TKIs and large phase 3 trials based on solid early data. Sapphire looking at sitravatinib and Nivo, Contact looking at cabozantinib and atezolizumab, and Leap looking at lenvatinib and pembro, all completely negative. So I think that really the onus is on proving this. Pembro-ram is not really something I would give off study, but I really am looking forward to seeing those Pragmatica results. Other novel strategies, we've got to think out of the box, and the goal here is to promote immune responses. Tumor Treating Fields established approved treatments for mesothelioma, for GBM, and now for lung cancer based on the LUNAR EF-24 study. Here, a phase 3 trial looking at second-line immunotherapy or docetaxel. And so this study is a bit of an older study before we were using immunotherapy in the frontline setting. Tumor Treating Fields are a physical manifestation. You use a vest, as shown in the picture here, to deliver low alternating electrical current. And this interferes with several key processes, such as mitosis, and it does induce immunogenic cell death. And so by using Tumor Treating Fields in combination with standard treatment, what we saw in the LUNAR study was an improvement in survival. We saw an improvement overall, and in the group receiving immunotherapy, leveraging potentially an increase in immunogenic cell death, we saw an even greater improvement in survival with a hazard ratio of 0.63. It's an improved treatment. Is this something we use for everyone? No, there's a lot that goes into it. You do have to wear this vest for most of the day, sort of indefinitely until progression, and there are some pragmatic barriers to it. This is a survival benefit. And now we've seen some early data, at least by press release, in pancreatic cancer. So while this is an out-of-the-box treatment, survival is a hard endpoint. I think other studies will continue to define the role here. If something is working with immunotherapy, we'd expect more benefit in PD-L1 positive. That is what we see in the LUNAR EF-24 study. In the ASCO this past year, we saw the METIS trial here using the GBM device for patients with brain metastases who received SRS and then systemic therapy, randomized to also get Tumor Treating Fields or not. And we do see a pretty significant improvement in the time to intracranial progression. Hazard ratio 0.67, curves that look pretty similar to PCI in small cell, really, but with a different type of toxicity. And so very encouraging, very enticing. We already talked a bit about ivonescimab here, where we have cooperative binding. These are those curves we were talking about. Ivonescimab versus pembro, hazard ratio for PFS 0.51, We saw similar benefit for high and low PD-L1 for squamous and non-squamous. I think two big questions. One, does this translate to an OS benefit? And two, will this apply to a Western population? And we'll see those because confirmatory studies in the U.S. are already underway. Other immune strategies, we heard earlier in the HCC section about vaccines. OSE-2101 is a vaccine targeting five different tumor-associated antigens, HER2, CEA, MAGE 2 and 3, and P53. And Benjamin Best presented the ATALANTE-1 study that compared this to straight docetaxel. And again, in patients with secondary resistance to immunotherapy, the survival hazard ratio here, 0.59, an OS benefit. Are vaccines making their way back? The phase 3 Artemia trial will look to confirm this ongoing now. And then ADCs, where we talked about all day, all weekend, antibody-drug conjugates, T-DXd, hugely impactful in breast cancer, also in non-small cell lung cancer with HER2 mutations. We now have an approval for HER2 IHC 3+, as of April 2024. In that DESTINY-Lung3 study that Dave Planchard presented, we see the response rate 44%, 56% in IHC 3+. I think the lesson here is we need to be testing our tumors for IHC expression of HER2, because this will occur in about 20% of our patients with lung cancer. Here we see the PFS, 8.2 months, median survival, 17. Remember the standard here, docetaxel, these numbers are much better than standard chemotherapy. Telisotuzumab vedotin, maybe we should also be checking for MET-IHC, and this agent shown in the Luminosity study led by Ross Kamage showed a response rate of 29% in that CMET high, 35% response rate, PFS 6 months, survival 14 months. Is MET overexpression common? We see that in about a quarter of our patients without EGFR mutant lung cancer. And so here, this is a big subset of our patients. We will have a phase 3 trial, the TELEMET study, really comparing this to standard docetaxel. Lastly, datopotamab deruxtecan. We know the TROPION-Lung01 study compared datopotamab versus docetaxel. We saw a benefit in PFS, primarily in non-squamous. We saw almost a tripling of the response rate, but no improvement in survival. We see these OS curves really overlapping. It's now being explored in EGFR mutant lung cancer, where it does have a higher response rate, but do we need a new biomarker? TROP2 expression didn't seem to be predictive of benefit, but again, for the ADC to work, it not only needs expression of the receptor, it needs to be internalized. Marina Garasino presented a new biomarker where you upload a digital slide, and then it is analyzed by a deep learning machine algorithm. And using AI, we're looking at not just expression, but internalization of that receptor. That did seem to predict response. And so is this a new wave of AI-based biomarkers that we'll be using with digital pathology? I do think that's coming. And should we be using these in different ways in the frontline setting with immunotherapy? Can this disrupt the architecture of the microenvironment through bystander effect, promote more immune-mediated responses? The early single-arm studies, TROPION-Lung2 with Pembro, TROPION-Lung4 with Durva plus or minus chemo, have shown very high response rates. We need some randomized data to show, is this achieving short-term response or long-term survival? So stay tuned for those. We have multiple studies looking at integrating datopotamab in the early setting with Pembro chemo in TROPION-Lung08 or 7, with the TIGIT bispecific, or with chemotherapy. And so overall, immunotherapy is where it starts. A lot of different strategies. We need a little more data to help choose between those. Resistance is still our main unmet need, but we need some new strategies. Unfortunately, there are some new drugs and new classes that are coming.
So just come back to... Govindan, in terms of Dato-DXd, I'm curious what your thoughts are. Any hints about why we saw greater benefit with non-squamous? Any thoughts about this new assay? I've been bringing that up to the breast cancer people as well, because they have anti-TROPA ADCs as well. And where do you see it fitting in with EGFR disease?
So with all these ADCs, there are several things that play a role here in determining responses. One is a target that is variable expression. How do we assay them? How many molecules should be present for this to be active? And then the second part is that it has to be internalized, as Stephen said, and the internalization can be dictated by many things. And I don't think we understand that fully, although there is some understanding of what are the key steps required for this. And I think that can be a block there. The target may be expressed, but internalization may be limited. And then at the end of the day, everyone forgets one thing, that it is still chemotherapy. And these patients have had exposure to previous cytotoxic chemotherapy, and have resistance to one of those topoisomerase inhibitors, then no matter how you deliver it, how much you deliver inside the cell, it's not going to work. So I do think this predictive thing for the ADCs is going to be very complicated. It is contingent upon many things that we are just beginning to understand, barely scratching the surface, no pun intended. But I think that's where it is. And so it's going to take a little bit more time. Could AI help? Maybe, but I think it's gonna say this is a bit of a lot of hand waving here, but there's no easy quick answer to that. And I think a lot of these ADCs may fall by the wayside, partly because of the resistance of the chemotherapy, and the target may be expressed in the right context. It may be a great benefit. That's for the example is a HER2 targeted ADCs. That's really where you have delivered a drug, especially without overly too much chemo exposure, that may work.
Stephen, any thoughts about data on EGFR disease, second-line setting? Where do you think that's going to fit in?
It's hard to know if it's because of TROP2 and its role as a target in EGFR, or is it just that EGFR mutant lung cancer is more sensitive to topoisomerase 1 inhibition and can it be concentrated? And I think ultimately it'll be a combination of the two. EGFR is clearly where we're seeing more of a signal. We see TROPION-Lung05 looking at datopotamab in those with actionable genomic alterations. Response rates were higher. They seem to be durable in some patients. They do introduce some toxicity, but now suddenly this is a sort of a crowded space. We also know patritumab deruxtecan, was superior to chemotherapy in that setting. That's the same linker, the same payload as datopotamab. One wouldn't think you could use them in sequence, but it does need to be proven. So it's going to be a little bit of a crowded space. I think this is where the drug is active. That's why it's being pursued there. But where it fits in the algorithm remains to be seen.
So one more sort of basic question, getting back to you, Govindan, before we go to Lucio. Real simple question. What's your usual approach to metastatic disease with PD-1 negative patients?
It's an interesting question. I give chemoimmunotherapy.
I hear more and more people talking about, ipi-nivo or CTLA-4, PD-1, Stephen. What are you doing?
Yeah, I think that the outcomes, really, it has to be immunotherapy in some form or without direct head-to-head comparison. For PD-L1 0 and for squame, I do rely more on dual checkpoint plus chemo.
Question from the audience, Govindan. Should people in the community be looking for SKT11 or KIP1?
I think at the moment, I personally don't decide treatment based on the STK11 KEAP1 mutation changes. It's an interesting thing to explore. But I would be reluctant to give them single agent immunotherapy. That's the only thing I would say. I would add chemoimmunotherapy even if they have a high PD-L1 expression.
Lucio?
Yeah, I have a couple questions. 75-year-old person, targeted mutation, stage 4 upon diagnosis, and I start him on PD-L1 greater than 50%. I start him on pembrolizumab, response, and I stop at 2 years because I think we got the maximum response. And following the patient, the patient didn't want to stop, and I said, well, I think we can stop at this point. This was a few years ago. And then a year and a half later, he has progression of disease. So my questions are duration of therapy and what's the data on rechallenging with immunotherapy? Would you go back to pembro? Would you do duo? Or what would you do?
Even?
It depends on how robust they are, but I think in the perfect world, we want immunotherapy to cure our patients. We
right.
want durable response. And I also would stop at 2 years, and I think the data support it. We know that if we rechallenge, we can see responses, depending on the data set, response rate about 50%. And is that good or bad? I think it depends on if you're an optimist or a pessimist, but we can see responses. But to me, the likelihood of getting cure with that same treatment is pretty low, because if it was going to happen, it probably would have happened the first time. So when we can in that setting, outside of a trial, I do try to escalate. So if the patient's robust enough, maybe a dual checkpoint gets there. If you're a believer in the synergy, maybe chemo-IO. Depends on symptoms, site of disease. Pembro alone can respond. I think it's a very reasonable choice.
Right.
But if they're able to tolerate more, I might go for a home run with something a little higher.
Two studies guide you here, partly. One is a CheckMate 133, I think. This is the study where patients got nivolumab for a year and then stopped or continued. Mm-hmm. 1 year did not seem to be enough. So that part is enough. That part is, I think, reasonable. The second one is the nice analysis published by Dr. Agarwal and colleagues in JAMA Oncology that really looked at what happens after you stop after 2 years, similar to your patients. It turns out that about half of them do get require some treatment, and about half of those patients respond well to the first treatment going
right.
back. That's what I recall from the paper. But I think both are good options. You can try pembro alone or pembro and chemotherapy.
Yeah, the other question I had, sometimes when I start a patient with dual immunotherapy first line, PD-L1 usually less than 50 for this patient if they're robust. A couple times we see that these patients, you don't know for sure if they're being hyperprogressors or if this is an inflammatory response. How do you differentiate? Do you follow ctDNA for immunotherapy, other biomarker, PET scan, CAT scan? I usually go with CT scans and the patient is clinically stable, but it's not an easy clinical situation to be in.
Steven?
I think it's very challenging, and you know, I think ctDNA potentially has a role there, but one could imagine if it's going up, is that because you're seeing some response? So I don't know if it really settles the decision. Generally, in cases that are doing well with immunotherapy, regardless of CT and radiographic evidence, patients generally feel better. So if the patient's feeling well, but the scan shows a little bit of progression, I usually push on. But if they don't, it's usually progression. More and more, though, I am using chemotherapy to sort of avoid being put in that very difficult situation.
Yeah, makes sense. And the other practical question I have is the uptake of TT fields. Have you guys used it quite a bit in practice? I haven't seen much in community oncology yet, to some extent.
You?
I have not used it yet. It is getting a little more difficult to ignore when they keep having positive trials, especially when they're all OS.
And so really positive.
It is difficult to ignore it. I don't think we'll be able to. I think one piece for me is I'd love to just see more correlative biology. What exactly is happening to convince me? It's something new, and I think there's always some hesitance to change fields. And it is a big ask because it's not just a short-term treatment. If it works for years, you're wearing this vest for quite a long time. So in the right patient, I think it's absolutely appropriate. My advice, though, is to go in with eyes wide open to really know what we're signing up for.
It makes sense.
If the patient presents with metastatic non-small cell, it's non-squamous, high tumor bulk, extremely symptomatic, they're in the ICU, they need to be treated, you want to give them chemotherapy, you don't have the data back from NGS, would you add the IO, and would it make a difference whether the patient's a smoker or not?
You know, a couple of things. Technically, chemotherapy is what gives you immediate response. That's what they need in this situation. Immunotherapy can wait. And second, most hospital systems don't make it available in the inpatient setting, so that decision is taken out of your hand mostly. I don't feel a compelling need to add immunotherapy in an acute situation like that. We can always do it in cycle number two. The enthusiasm for adding immunotherapy will be a lot lower if a patient is a non-smoker.
Lucio, you have any other questions?
Any situations in which you would consider immunotherapy for a patient with an oncogenic targetable mutation?
Steven?
You know, not up front, and certainly not before targeted therapy for most drivers. I think that we make a distinction between EGFR, ALK, ROS, RET, and then BRAF, MET, certainly KRAS. KRAS, IO should be first. I think that the discussion is very interesting about BRAF and MET. And when we think of melanoma, we know from the DREAMseq study that, you know, targeted therapy should not be first, that immunotherapy should be first. Now, you know, melanoma and lung cancer are very different diseases, and I generally prefer targeted therapy in those settings before immuno, but mostly because I think the toxicity of the reverse sequence is greater, and so I'd rather give targeted therapy before immunotherapy if we're going to do both. But for generally EGFR and ALK, IO is not part of my initial strategy.
Sure.
At the very end of treatment, later lines, potentially. Yeah. But those are settings where we really look for something more than just off-the-shelf PD-1, PD-L1. Will it be ivonescimab? I'm looking at Harmony's data. Will it be a new novel clinical trial? That's really where I try to get something better than Pembro. We know Pembro, atezo-nivo alone, response rate can be about 5%.
So, Govindan, you have a patient with metastatic disease that's BRAF positive. You're going to use an IO?
Yes. Chemo-IO, and I agree with Steven that I think when you see oncogenic mutations, mostly EGFR, KRAS, ROS, EGFR, ALK, ROS, RET, KRAS mutant patients actually respond well to immunotherapy. The subsets may not, but I think KRAS is also neoantigenic in many instances. So it is a group that we should not lump it with the EGFR and ALK. I also think the common thread between EGFR, ALK, ROS, RET is the non-smokers. Non-smokers have 10 times less mutation burden in the tumor compared to the smokers, and the biology is very different, and that's one of the reasons why they don't respond to immunotherapy with PD-1, PD-L1, PD-1. Their immune evasion mechanisms are very different.
So, Stephen, I know we're talking about immunotherapy, but you brought up the issue of HER2. Just kind of curious right now how you think about integrating HER2-specific therapy, particularly TDXD, what line of therapy you think about with a HER2 mutant or HER2 overexpression and even HER2 low?
So for HER2 mutant, we know T-DXd is approved in second line and beyond after initial treatments, whether it's chemotherapy or chemo-IO. But to me, you've got a drug with a very high response rate, some CNS efficacy. I don't think the tolerability is worse than platinum doublet chemotherapy. So ever since we saw those data and its approval in the second line space, that's become my frontline standard off study. That is off label on the boards. I'm giving chemo IO in that setting, but I really do think T-DXd is a better treatment in that setting. Now, HER2 overexpressed, not quite as common in lung cancer as other diseases. And there, it's a setting where the genotypes may be a little different, where when I see HER2 overexpression, sometimes those are heavy smokers and they may respond quite well to immunotherapy. So I'm not ready to forfeit the opportunity for long-term survival. Those patients, HER2 overexpressing, no other alterations, still going chemo IO frontline, and I'll use T-DXd second line and beyond.
HER2 two plus?
Two plus is not quite as robust. Response rates there about 35%. The approval for three plus, that's really where most of the activity is. And so if you're talking about versus docetaxel, I think it's an open discussion, but really I'm mostly using it just for the HER2 three plus.
All right, we're going to move on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.